This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the In Focus podcast. I'm your host, G. Sampath. The India Employment Report 2024, released recently by the International Labour Organization, ILO, paints a grim picture. The news is particularly bad on two critical counts. Joblessness is high among the youth, and secondly, it's worse for the educated youth. According to the report, India's youth account for 83% of the unemployed workforce in the country, with the share of the educated youth among the total unemployed doubling from 35.2% in 2000 to 65.7% in 2022. Among other things, the report also flags a reversal of the expected transition of the workforce from agriculture to the non-farm sector and says that India's female labor force participation rate has declined by 14.4 percentage points between 2000 and 2019. So what do all these numbers mean for India's demographic dividend, so to speak, that people keep talking about? Why is 82% of the workforce in the informal sector, with nearly 90% informally employed? And why is the share of manufacturing in employment stagnating at 12 to 14%? We take a close look at the key findings of this report in this episode of In Focus, and we are joined today by someone who was closely involved in the making of this report, Professor Ravi Srivastava, Director, Center for Employment Studies at the Institute for Human Development, New Delhi. Ravi, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to In Focus.
Thank you, Sampath, for inviting me to this podcast. The report, as you know, is actually a teamwork. I'm one of the team leaders, but several people were involved in the making of the report. I was one of them, one of the team leaders. I'm happy to answer your questions today.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for once again for your time here. So to start with, Ravi, the report talks about, quote unquote, paradoxical improvements in key labor market indicators. And from what I understood, things kept worsening from 2000 until 2019. And then when economic distress peaked during the pandemic, the COVID crisis, the labor market indicators started to improve. Is this what the report means by paradoxical? I mean, what are the implications or the takeaways for the layman, so to speak, of this paradox?
Thanks, Sampath. The changes in labor market conditions are tracked in a summary form through key labor market indicators. These are three: the labor force participation rate, the worker population ratio, alternatively also known as the workforce participation rate, and the unemployment rate. Now, these summary indicators do not comprehensively cover all aspects of the labor market, especially in a country like India, where employment and unemployment are themselves very elusive concepts. But nevertheless, they provide an entry point when we study labor market changes. Now, with the pandemic, one expects that the key labor market indicators would show a worsening. Now, what our data and results actually show is that these indicators deteriorated in the pre-pandemic period between 2000 and 2019. And then, paradoxically, to use the word that you have used, when the pandemic happened, and in the succeeding years, from 2019-20 onwards, they begin to show an improvement. For example, the labor force participation rate came down from 61.6% in 99,000, which I'll refer to 99,000 with the final, this is 2000, to 50.2% in 2019.
Right. Ravi, sorry to interrupt. Can you please explain for a layman's understanding, what is the difference between these three summary indicators, the labor force participation rate, unemployment rate, and workforce? To me, it all sounds very similar. Like, what are the key differentiating elements of these three?
So the labor force participation rate measures the percentage of people in the population in a particular age group. You know, when we talk about youth, the age group is 15 to 29. When we talk about the population as a whole, in this report, we are talking about the 15 plus age group. So the labor force participation rate simply measures the number of people who are working or are willing to work the ratio of people who are working or willing to work in that particular age group. So let's say if six out of 10 people are working or willing to work, then the labor force participation rate will be 60%. The worker population ratio measures the percentage of people who are actually working. So for example, if 5 people out of 10 are actually working, then the worker population ratio will be 50%. And if 1 out of 10 people are unemployed, they're seeking work, but they're not able to get work, then the unemployment rate is 10%. So these are very key indicators, but one of them showing how many people are willing to work or are actually working, the ratio of these people. Secondly, the percentage of people actually working in any age group. Thirdly, the percentage of people who are willing to work but are unable to get work. That is the unemployment rate.
Okay. So the difference between the first and the second category is that in the first one, it includes both those who are willing to work as well as those who are actually working, that is the labor force participation rate, and the worker population rate is the percentage who are actually working, regardless of...
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, please go on, yeah.
So the unemployment rate, just also to basically also make the point that the unemployment rate, the workforce participation rate and the labor force participation rate are ratios to the total population in that age group. But the unemployment rate is the ratio of the labor force participation rate. So the percentage of people who are unable to get employment as a percentage of people who are willing to work. Or so that is a slight difference. The denominator changes when we talk about the unemployment rate. Okay, so now what has happened is that this ratio, the first broad ratio, the labor force participation rate, it came down from 61.6% for males and females combined in 2000 to 50.2% in 2019. But then it slowly increased to 57.9% in 22-23. The same thing, you see a similar trajectory as far as the worker population ratio is concerned. It fell from 60.2% to 47.3% in the period up to 2019, and then it increased to 56% by 2023. So both the decline in the first period and the subsequent increase have been sharper for female workers. So when it comes to female workers, the decline was very sharp in the first period, but then there has been almost a mirror increase in the second period for them. So this is as far as workforce and labor force participation rate is concerned. The unemployment rate actually for all workers taken together, this increased from 2.6% in 2018-19 to 5.6% in 2018-19. For increase from 2.6% in 2000 to 5.6% in 2019, and then has since fallen to 3.2%. So you see that the there's a reverse movement as far as the unemployment rate is concerned compared to the labor force participation rate and the workforce participation rate. So now we observe a similar trend for the youth population. When we look at the youth population alone, we see a similar trend. Now, this improvement is in fact paradoxical, right? Because you're seeing an improvement where you otherwise would have expected a deterioration. In fact, if you look more closely at the quarterly data, and we have every data for every 3 months available from the PLFS, this reveals a deterioration in these three indicators only in two quarters. And these two quarters correspond to the peak COVID outbreaks and lockdowns from April to June 20. And then again from April to June 2021. In these two quarters, we see a deterioration. But otherwise, when we see the annual rates, we see an improvement throughout the pandemic period. What I want to emphasize is that if you do a deeper analysis, if you dig deeper and do a deeper analysis of labor market changes that have occurred since 2019, in terms of the factors that underlie these changes, why have these changes occurred? Then this appears to offer some explanations for this apparent paradox. And when we do this deep digging, we are able to show that although the key labor market indicators improved during the pandemic, the composition and the structure of employment were deeply impacted. mostly, although perhaps not entirely, by the pandemic. So actually, when you do a deeper analysis, you do find a deep impact of the pandemic.
Right. So when you say the structure and composition has been impacted, do you mean that because of people, I mean, mostly men losing their jobs, more women have entered the workforce, and is that the reason why these labor indicators have improved? Is that one of the reasons, or are there other factors at play?
We can go into this, because this basically brings us to the questions of where exactly has the increase happened, and what is the nature of this increase? Whether it is self-employed or whether it is own account workers, the kind of where have the increases occurred? Have they occurred in rural areas? Have they occurred in agriculture? And I think we can come back to some of these questions a little later. But I just want to find out that I want to say that going forward, because one of the questions is that this has occurred and there seems to be a deep impact of the pandemic on a deeper analysis. But what will happen going forward? Now, actually, if you going forward, if you want healthier changes, if you anticipate healthier changes in employment conditions, there should actually be a growth in better quality employment outside of agriculture. So what will we be looking at? We'll be looking at whether there is growth in better quality employment outside of agriculture. The latest year data, that is the 22-23 data, although the trends are still the same, this does seem to show that the reverse changes are slowing down. Although we have a long way to go before the health of the labor market is fully restored. So these are some of the questions which we can come back to.
Right. I mean, that's a very important point you made, Ravi. Growth in better quality employment outside agriculture, I think that's a key. I mean, one, of course, growth in any employment outside agriculture is the first step. And then, of course, the quality matters, what kind of employment, informal, semi-formal. So we'll come back to that, I think, subsequently. Now, one of the things which struck me while going through this report was this employment conditions index, which was prepared for this report. So can you explain, like, how does this index, what is its composition structure, and what are the major trends that it has revealed in the past decade or so when it comes to employment conditions?
Yes, the report has prepared an employment condition index, and this has been prepared to assess changes in the quality of employment over time and across states in India. This index is based on 7 variables, which depict the population, including the youth populations, income status and employment status. These 7 variables are, number 1, the percentage of workers employed as regular formal workers. 2, the worker population ratio, which I have already explained. 3, the proportion of self-employed workers with an income below the poverty line. 4, the percentage of casual workers. 5, the average monthly income of casual workers. 6, the unemployment rate of educated youth, that is secondary with secondary education and more. 7, youth who are not in employment, education or training, which are basically called NEET youth, NEET. Now, in the preparation of this index, what we have done is that we have assigned maximum and minimum values to each indicator. And these have been fixed in a way that we can compare changes over time and across states. And these indicator values will always lie between 0 and 1. The employment condition index is the average for all the indicator values. What we do find, so basically this is the 7 variables relate to the youth population and the overall population. They relate to employment status and also the income status of the workers. Now, this employment condition index shows an improvement in the overall scores across India. Across time, we have 4 points of time over which we have carried out this exercise, as well as for each state. So each state does show an improvement in quality over between 2004-5 and 21-22. Broadly speaking, the states at the top and at the bottom remain the same, but there are some states...
Which are the states at the top and which are the worst, so to speak, at the bottom of this index?
The states at the top are Delhi, Himachal, Uttarakhand, Telangana. These are, for example, the 4 states at the top. the states at the bottom are the states like Bihar, Odisha, Uttar Pradesh, Jharkhand. These are generally the states at the top. There are some states which have actually were in the lower quartile at the beginning, for example, Kerala, but which at the end of the period make it to the upper quartile, which means they are in the top one-fourth of the states that we look at. So there are some changes across in the ranking of the states across.
Slightly at a bit of a tangent to this, Ravi, I was just wondering, so if you, the report also talks about migration of workers, which we'll come to later, but very quickly, would it be like fair to assume that the migration of the workforce is generally from the states at the bottom of the employment conditions index to those at the top? Is that a broad trend?
They are generally from the states which are at the bottom of the index to states which are at the middle and the top.
Okay.
Yeah. Because some of the middle income, some of the states which are in the second quartile have, as it were, mixed, they have mixed indicators as far as labor markets are concerned. Average wages may be high, but the informality may be high and so on. So they are generally, the migration is from the lower quartile to the states which are in the upper two quartiles.
Right. So now, coming to another very key finding, which sort of was flagged by many. So as countries develop,
if I can just very briefly interject, we also actually put another index in the report, and this is called the Employment Structure Index. This index is based on weighting six types of employment. So this is only based on employment, not incomes, and this is formal employment, regular and informal employment in the formal sector, regular but informal employment in the informal sector, self-employment, casual wage employment in the formal sector, and casual employment in the informal sector. So the better types of employment have a higher weight. In other words, a shift from the poorer type of employment to a better type of employment improves the index.
Right. So what is the difference between casual employment and informal employment?
Casual employment is employment which is generally people, workers who are hired by the day. So they have a daily contract with their current employer. Whereas workers can be hired by the day, or workers can be hired for a period of time. If they hire for a period of time and are paid a wage accordingly, then they're known as regular workers. Now, all workers, whether they are casual workers or whether they are regular workers or whether they are piece rate workers, if they do not have any job security or social security, they are known as informal workers. So informal workers are actually all workers without job security. And there are a large number of, there is in fact a growing percentage of workers in the organized or formal sector of the economy now who are regular workers, but who are in the category of informally employed workers. So that is the distinction.
Right. And that is going to sort of, I think, bring down the employment structure or employment conditions index, or maybe both.
It will have an impact on both. It will have an impact on both because it finds a place in both the indices. But the employment structure index shows that it shows an improvement between 2000 and 2019, but it remains unchanged between 2019 and 2022. So you see that the direction of the employment structure index is actually very different from the summary labor market indicators that we have, because it is looking at the structure of employment.
Right. So Ravi, as I was sort of getting to this question, as a country develops, the labor market is expected to undergo a transition. And it's a very common trend. The bulk of employment shifts from agriculture to non-farm sectors. It's happened in all countries. But in India, this trend seems to have reversed after the pandemic of 2018, 2019. So what are the implications of this reversal? Does this mean that manufacturing and services are failing to generate adequate employment to absorb the labor that is moving away from agriculture?
That is correct. Globally, development is accompanied by a structural transformation in which workers move from low productivity sectors to higher productivity sectors, generally from agriculture to industry and services. And usually, we expect that this movement to higher productivity sectors will also be accompanied by higher incomes and better quality of employment. Now, this will happen if workers who move out of agriculture are able to secure better and formal jobs in the formal sector of the economy. Now, in the period up to 2019, the structure of employment changed slowly, but in a manner consistent with this development hypothesis. So we had actually a decline in agricultural employment and an increase in non-farm employment. Improvement in the quality of employment itself were very slow due to shifts in low productivity, because the labor actually shifted to sectors such as construction, which were low productivity, and because jobs got informalized rather than getting formalized. But in the more recent phase, the structural change has been reversed, and there has been a movement back to agriculture and to construction, mainly to construction. And there has been a greater informalization in the structure of employment. In fact, what we find is that between 99,000 and 2019, the numbers and proportion of workers in agriculture fell from 61.5% to 41.4%. But then in the subsequent years, between 19 and 22, this share increased from 45.4% by 2022. In the first period, and this you must note, employment in agriculture fell at an annual rate of 2.2% per year. Whereas in the second phase, 2018-19 to 21-22, it increased at the rate of 8.9% per year. Now, one implication for this is that the average productivity per worker in agriculture actually fell in the more recent period. So not only did workers move to a low productive area sector, but they also contributed to a worsening of average productivity per worker in that area. The youth workforce actually also experienced the same kind of same trend. There was a rapid increase in the non-farm sector in the first phase, and then a decline in the second. And then in the second phase, there was a rapid increase in agriculture, which a much slower increase in the non-farm employment among youth. And as far as employment is concerned, overall, the quality of employment and share of formal workers has remained low throughout this period, and also as a share of the workforce. And then informality increased post-2019. What we do is we provide other metrics for the quality of employment, which I have mentioned did experience some overall improvements while remaining poor. And these metrics show that the overall quality, even though some improvement was experienced, still remained very low. For example, nationally in 2022, 40.8% regular workers and 52% casual workers did not receive a minimum wage. So these features together imply that the non-farm sector, to answer your question, failed to provide adequate good quality jobs throughout this period. But the crunch was really severe post-2018-19. This is the period when actually, as a result of the pandemic, this crunch became really severe.
So did the pandemic crisis force workers to sort of move back? I mean, we do know that a lot of urban workers reverse migrated back to their villages. So was that one of the factors for the increase in the employment in the agriculture sector post-pandemic?
See, two kinds of changes have taken place. One, that workers, yes, as you rightly say, that workers moved to low remunerative jobs, self-employment and so on. And secondly, they moved back to the agricultural sector. Again, generally doing low remunerative jobs. And this seems to be mainly a result of the pandemic, although the trend started in the immediate pre-pandemic year, but this certainly aggravated a great deal during the pandemic.
Right. So the trend started before the pandemic, and that's an important, I think, point to be noted, because it points to larger issues with the structure of the labor market and the economy. Now, one of the key trends, Ravi, which has been flagged in the report, is that almost 2/3 of the incremental employment after 2019 was in self-employment. And I'm just placing this alongside what the chief economic advisor recently said, that, it is not the government's job to create, solve social economic problems like unemployment. So what is this trend telling us? Is India's workforce expected to become more and more, quote unquote, Atmanirbhar, find self-employment rather than go look for jobs?
So a very high percentage of self-employed workers, upwards of 50%, has been a characteristically structural feature of the Indian economy. But this percentage saw a steady increase between 2019 and 22, from 52% in 2019 to 52.4% in 20, 55.5% in 21, and then 55.8% in 22. So you have a steady increase, very sharp increase in the main pandemic year, but a steady increase in self-employment. Now, these self-employed workers are categorized either as employers or as own account workers. In other words, they are working on their tiny enterprises without any hired help, or as unpaid family workers. In other words, they're only part of a family enterprise. Out of the total increase of 63.1 self-employed persons in these years, 40% were own account workers, 5% were employers, and 55% were unpaid family workers. The bulk of these were women in rural areas and in agriculture. So this cannot be a long-term, or certainly this cannot be a long-term healthy trend for this. Now, there appear to be two main explanations for this. First, that with a jobs constraint, self-employment opportunities can be easily accessed. There is what people call ease of entry. Secondly, that in a period of crisis, joining a family enterprise with the aim of either protecting or augmenting family incomes appears to be a fairly rational choice. So both these, you know, lead to an increase in these kind of jobs during a crisis.
Right. I mean, family enterprise, of course, I mean, there are limits on what kind of enterprises or productive activities are possible within the ambit of a family enterprise. Anyway, that's a separate debate. Now, the report also says, Ravi, I quote, nearly 82% of the workforce engages in the informal sector and nearly 90% is informally engaged, employed, unquote. So, I mean, I think you already explained this distinction between informally employed versus employed in the informal sector. But is there anything larger in terms of a trend that you want to talk about in this context?
Well, you know, the informal, the organized sector or the formal sector of the economy has been slowly increasing till 2019. The share of the informal sector increased, but then it declined. Between 2019 and 2022, it declined. The share of formal workers improved a little bit between 2012 and 2019, and then it has again dipped. So between 2019 and 22, the share of the formal sector in the economy and the share of formal workers in the economy both came down. This is something that which is again has to do with actually the kind of jobs that were being created or that were being accessed between 2019 and 2022.
So the rise of the gig economy, so to speak, you know, the entire gig economy would be in these two categories, right? Informal jobs and informal sector, or would it be formal sector, informal jobs?
The gig economy tends to mask the actual employment relationship. There is an actual employment relationship with the platform, but this is often masked as being contracted out. So these workers tend to be getting treated as, you know, and there is a global dispute about the nature of work which gig workers do, whether they are actually employees of the platforms or whether they are own account workers, you know, working on contracts with the platforms. Mm-hmm. But technically, they are like contract workers. They are like contract workers with the platforms. So they fall in this category of informal workers. There's no doubt that they fall in the category of informal workers. But they have a relationship with the platforms which are highly organized.
Right. So, in your report, for instance, how do you classify Uber drivers and, you know, Zomato delivery boys? And are they self-employed or are they classified as casual workers or whatever?
So they come in the they're certainly not casual workers. They come in the category of those who are informally employed. But there is a gray area whether we consider them as being directly employed in the formal sector, which they are not. So basically, they're part of the informal sector, but they're in a contract relationship with the formal sector of the economy.
Right, right. I mean, it is indeed a gray area. So in this context, you know, Ravi, I was going to ask you, the big headline of this report was that, you know, educated youth not finding employment. A huge percentage of India's educated youth they comprise a huge percentage of the overall unemployed. So how easy or difficult is it for the average graduate? I mean, we know that the more and more of India's unemployed are more and more educated, so to speak. So how difficult or easy is it for the average graduate to find a regular job? And when I say regular job, I mean regular in the way, in the terms of how the report means regular.
Issues related to the links between education, skills and youth employment are discussed threadbare in the major part of the report. That is the focus of the report. So I'll have to give you a slightly long-winded answer. And to summarize some of our main conclusions, what we find is the worker participation rate, of course, is naturally lower among youth than among adults due to their participation in education. But even after making an allowance for education, the report finds that this ratio has fallen over the years. In general, the youth actually end up being more in industry and services and in skilled employment than adults. But on average, the quality of employment is poorer among them. We find that technological change and digitization is rapidly affecting the demand for skills and for certain types of jobs. But although the percentage of youth the percentage of youth in medium high skilled jobs has increased, in 22, only 14.9% youth were in this category. This is much lower than the demand for such jobs among the youth. The youth are getting more and more educated and they aspire for high-skilled jobs. But the growth in high-skilled jobs is actually much lower than that. You have used three types of metrics to measure unemployment. The first is the unemployment rate, which I have already talked about. The second is time-related unemployment or underemployment, which is a characteristic feature of economies like India. The third is youth not in employment, education, or training, which is NEET. I mentioned this very briefly in the beginning. Now, unemployment rate among youth actually were 5.7% in 2000, rose till 2018 and 19, and then declined to 12.4% in 22. So they were still more than twice as high in 22 as they were in 2000. But what is interesting is that they're very high NEET rates. NEET rates among youth were nearly 30% in 2000. Then they rose between 2000 and 2019, and they were nearly 29% in 2022. And these rates are nearly five times higher for women, 48.4%, than among young males, 9.8%. So you have to note that, we should not get stuck only on unemployment rates, because NEET is really a very important category when we want to look at employment creation. We have noted that there are very impressive gains in education attainment that have been made since 2000. In 2000, only 5% youth were graduates. This increased to nearly 15% in 22. The share of all secondary and higher level educated youth increased from about 28% to almost 59% over this period. Now, the higher the level of education, the better are the returns to education. And that is why, and the highly educated youth are more likely to be in better quality jobs. This explains the propensity of youth to attain high levels of education. They aspire for high levels of education because the returns from such education are very high. But we find that that access to technical education and formal skills are still very low among the youth population, and only 4% were formally trained.
So what about all the skilling programs and Skill India initiative? So wasn't that all about increasing the technical skill level of the youth so that they are able to match the demand for skilled jobs in the market? I mean, a lot of private companies have CSR initiatives going on where they are doing skilling work and so on. So has that not had adequate impact in terms of raising the skill levels to match the market demand for those skills?
Can I just answer about your first question first?
Yeah, sure.
We just come back to the question of skills. So what we find is there are deep inequalities by socioeconomic status across all types of education. And this has implications for the labor market, across social groups, across economic groups and all that. Unemployment rates actually rise with rising levels of education. In 22, only 3.2% of the youth with below primary education were unemployed, but almost 29% youth with graduate or higher education were unemployed. These unemployed rates were highest among the SC and ST youth. So basically, if you are lower in the social order, And if you have a graduate degree, then there is a greater chance that you will be unemployed. Okay. So now basically, as the stock of young educated people rises, so does the challenge of employment among youth. Because the more educated you are, the more likely you are to remain unemployed, at least for a period of time. And with a period of time, the stock of educated people is rising. What we examine, another very interesting dimension in this report, which is a mismatch between education level and jobs among the highly educated youth. This question of mismatch is always mentioned. And you can see this, you know, there is a job vacancy is advertised for clerks or for peons, and literally several 100,000 young people apply for, you know, a handful of jobs.
Including PhDs, yeah.
Yes, including PhDs and all that. And so we have analyzed this question actually threadbare in this report. And what we find is that the mismatch in terms of youth with graduate high education level doing low skill jobs increased between 2004 and 2120. It was already very high in the early 2000s. It increased between 2004 and 2022. Basically, to summarize, we find structural changes to educated youth employment had to have a tendency to increase over the years. And this requires urgent attention both on the supply and demand side. So basically, this is a slightly long-winded answer to your question that what are the prospects facing young graduates? The prospects facing, we find this to be a very important policy challenge in the present day and age. I'll revert to now your question, Rikils. Just to make the point first that we need to make a distinction between formal and informal skill training. Formal skill training programs follow a defined structure, and candidates who are undergoing these programs will undergo an evaluation at the end. You know, they'll pass, but in order to be given a certificate, they will have to pass an evaluation test. We have moved India towards aligning our skill training courses with the skill qualification framework. Now, being standardized, once formal skills are standardized, they are much more easily marketable. On the other hand, non-formal skill training programs do not follow a well-defined structure, and they can be acquired on the job, they can be acquired through self-learning in hereditary occupations and other forms of non-formal training. The overall impact of the formal skill training programs in the public and private sector is assessed by the Employment Unemployment Surveys and more recently by these periodic labor force surveys. What we find is that the impact of formal skill training programs has been very low, with only 4.2% of the youth having acquired formal skill training. So basically, the changes that have taken place in the skill training ecosystem, and there have been quite a few changes that have occurred in the last 15 years, particularly since 2007-08, and then over increasing pace since 2014-15, since a new ministry was set up. They have still failed, not impacted appreciably on the goals which were set by the national skills policy. We're still way behind. And there's a great deal more work to be done in this direction.
Is the low impact because not enough youth are joining these programs, or is it because despite having joined them, they're not getting employment with the skills they have acquired? Is that which of the two is a problem?
So the data shows that on the supply side, there is a question of capacity constraint, question of infrastructure, question of trainers, all these are this thing. And on the demand side, the youth, actually, there is a low demand for skill training in many areas, and the low demand exists because youth who get skilled don't get jobs.
So, sir, are we then having a situation here where we are training a youth in skills for which the demand is low?
It is a situation both where we are training youth in demand, which in trades, in occupations where demand is low. But more importantly, once youth are skilled, the labor market is still not willing to pay a premium on those skills. So those youth go into informal jobs in the labor market where they are not adequately remunerated. And this then causes, this basically bounces back into a cycle where the demand for skill training becomes low. So there are problems here, both on the supply side of the skills market and also on the demand side of the skills market, which need to be resolved.
Right. I mean, it's a very complicated scenario here. I mean, on the one hand, of course, you're pointing to the fact that employers are not ready to pay the premium for the skilled worker, you know, for having acquired a skill, and therefore he or she ends up going back into the informal or the semi-skilled or unskilled aspect. And then, of course, what is even more difficult for me to wrap my head around is why, I mean, if the government is running these skilling programs, I mean, they would have a pretty good idea of, you know, which skills are in such great demand that even employers would want to pay whatever is adequate or the right amount of salaries or wages for those skilled workers. But despite that, they end up getting skilled and the demand is low and they're not able to get the wages. But it seems like a bit of a messy situation.
Actually, one of the key factors is that the participation of the private sector in skill training is very low. If the private sector were to acquire a greater stake in skill training and also bear a greater part of the cost of skill training, then the chances are that skill training would be better integrated in labor market systems. And that is a deficiency which is well recognized. The government recognizes it. Various reports have stressed this. The low priority that actually the private sector places on participating in skill training.
Right. I mean, the private sector not participating adequately in skill training is another factor, I think, a problem area. I think you have flagged. Thank you for that, Ravi. So one last question before I let you go. So, I mean, we have discussed the overall employment, unemployment scenario in the country as reflected in the report. We've discussed the relationship between education and employment / unemployment. We've discussed the impact or the lack of impact of skilling programs. So having looked at all these various aspects of this issue, so in terms of policy measures to address this core question of employment, the report, among various suggestions, calls for, I mean, what struck me was it calls for making production and growth more employment intensive. So in your experience, how serious a factor, if at all, is this in national economic policy making? You know, when I say this, I mean employment generation. Are big structural decisions about the economy taken with the eye on employment generation, or is employment generation typically seen as a secondary or a sub-problem, you know, secondary to growth targets, you know, a secondary problem which can be addressed independently, you know, through employment schemes like NAREGA and so on. My question is, is there a consensus in the Indian policy-making ecosystem that the government has the prime responsibility for job creation, and when it's framing its economic policies, job creation has to be topmost? Is that how we do our economics in this country? I mean, it's a broad question, but I'm interested to know your views and thoughts.
You know, as you pointed out, the report sets an emerging policy agenda, and this is spelled out in terms of 5 missions and a number of submissions. The very first of these is to make production and growth more employment intensive. But we do have other missions. For example, we argue for a series of measures to improve the quality of jobs. This includes suggestions for a regulatory framework and an urbanization and migration policy, which we believe is very important. Third, it suggests various measures to overcome labor market inequalities. This again includes measures to boost women's employment, bridge the digital divide, and regional level policies.
When you say labor market inequalities, do you mean only gender-based inequalities, or do you have other things in mind?
No, we actually, in the report, we flag gender inequalities, we flag social inequalities. So we actually flag all types of inequalities in the report. And we suggest measures, including, for example, anti-discrimination measures, which should be in place in the labor market, policies to boost women's employment, policies to bridge the digital divide. And also we point out that there should be, because labor markets are very regional in character, therefore we should have regional level policies. Then we argue, as we were just discussing, to make the system for skills development and active labor market policies more effective. And then finally, we call for bridging knowledge deficits regarding labor market and youth employment patterns, which is basically a call for better data. Now, the report's emphasis on employment-intensive strategy which you've talked about, this forms the cornerstone of our recommendations. The report suggests that such a strategy should be pursued synchronously by all ministries and departments. So there has to be a lot of synergy, and it should focus on labor-intensive manufacturers. So we are still basically building on we believe the labor-intensive manufacturing is still the cornerstone of our overall employment-intensive strategy. This does not mean that the service sector or the agricultural sector need to be neglected, but that manufacturing has to be the pivot for this kind of strategy. And this in turn, this calls for a focus on small and medium industry, expanding the green and blue economies, reaping the potential of the care economy, and so on. Now, you're absolutely right. What we are arguing is that such a strategy should be central to the growth process and not merely an offshoot to it. By implication, we are saying that at the moment, in successive economic strategies, employment is not at the core of economic strategies. It's basically an offshoot out of it. We do acknowledge the several steps which have been taken by the central government, but we call for a more cohesive strategy, both at the central level and also at the regional or state levels. Now, schemes for public employment generation, you know, MNREGA and all that, have a role to play in meeting the demand for employment, but they do not substitute for key strategies. So they can't take the place of actually building an employment-intensive growth strategy. When the report was launched, and you already referred to it, the chief economic advisor to the government stressed the government's role in policy making as a facilitator for employment growth. We accept that. I would further, in my personal capacity, call for making this central to the growth strategy. That part, I think, needs to be emphasized.
Right. Thank you so much, Ravi, for explaining this entire policy dimension of employment generation. I mean, it's a very strong recommendation and a point that you're making. Economic growth has to be employment, and the growth strategy has to be employment intensive. But then we have had many people in the government, even the report refers to it, this whole question of artificial intelligence. This is my final question to you. I mean, we have we have followed the Western model, where when you talk about economic strategy, the focus, the biggest focus has always been increasing or improving productivity, you know. And with AI, artificial intelligence coming into the picture, isn't there a kind of a contradiction where you're trying to increase productivity using artificial intelligence and autonomous machines and so on? At the same time, you also want to be employment intensive, because there is a social dimension to the economics, right? You want your citizens to find jobs, to be able to sustain their livelihoods. So is there a contradiction or not between the larger macroeconomic forces which are impelling your strategy towards increasing productivity as a means of promoting growth, whereas your social requirement for being employment intensive? But is there a contradiction? If it is there a way to resolve this contradiction?
So there is a natural tendency or a very strong tendency for growth to become more and more capital intensive, and therefore to reduce the potential for jobs. And in the present period, even manufacturing with Industry 4.0 technologies, with artificial intelligence, both manufacturing and the service sector are likely to become much more skill intensive and also much more capital intensive. Now, therefore, there are considerable challenges in actually talking about employment generation when these broad trends are actually hitting the economy in some ways. And this can only be done by building, as I said, labor-intensive growth, export-oriented, as well as oriented towards the deeper, as well as oriented towards a domestic economy as a core strategy. If you build this as a core strategy and then weave other strategies around it, then the chances are that we will be able to generate enough jobs. Manufacturing has a great deal, even now, a great deal of potential to be able to do labor-intensive manufacture, particularly because of the space which is being vacated by China, and that we are already striving to actually take advantage of value chains and things. So it's possible to be able to do it, but we have to aim to do it. That would be my key message.
Right. Thank you so much, Ravi. I mean, that's a very important message indeed. I mean, it has to be a core strategy. Labor-intensive growth strategy has to be part of your core economic approach. And of course, there are opportunities as well. If there are challenges, there are opportunities as well. As you rightly pointed out, China's vacating the space in terms of, you know, in labor, and also the entire Western a pivot away from China in terms of looking for manufacturing bases and so on. So there are opportunities and there are challenges, and of course it remains to be seen the wisdom of our policymakers to what extent they are able to absorb the entire reality facing them and generate appropriate policy measures to boost employment generation. Thank you so much, Ravi. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you, listening to your observation, your data-based insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sampath. Thank you so much.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.